that time again. It is time for the chef. Chef Andre Blassingame will be right here to bring us another great show, as he does every Monday, right here at the top of the hour. It is none other than Chef Andre Blass on Menu Monday, right here, ITRNRadio.com.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. It's the Chef Dre Blass, Coach Andre Blassingame, coming at you once again with Menu Monday. I am flat out excited as I open every show the same way to be here for everybody that's listening all over the world and international to ITRNRadio.net and my show, The Recipe Menu Mondays. As always, we got wonderful Kenny Hendricks, you know, doing all the behind-the-scenes production and programming, doing a fantastic job. And I've always got my special guest host, Miss Colette Williams, a.k.a. Yolanda, a.k.a. Media Mogul, a.k.a. Millionaire, a.k.a. Boss Lady.
Yeah. But you know what? Don't give me all those accolades, because I got to give them to you. Folks, I wish you would say thank you, congratulations, God bless you to our chef, Andre Blassingame, who was at the World Food Competition over the weekend. And he is a spectacular, fantastic, wonderful, one-of-a-kind chef. He is Chef Andre Blassingame. Congratulations on all your work. Congratulations on all that you do. Fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. So I just want to say thank you. It's an honor and a privilege to even know you. And you went as far as you did, and God took you every step of the way, and you deserve it. You really and truly deserve it. And as I say to you every week, I love your show because you have so much to talk about. I love your energy. Everything that you do is so infectious. So I just want to say thank you so much.
If I had my camera on, you see how red my cheeks were. Just saying.
Good.
I'm just sitting here like, wow. You know, it's. Yeah. All right, Kenny.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, man.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
It is an honor.
Yeah, I'm honored to be among those chefs. I mean, for anybody listening, you know, I've talked about the World Food Championships, I don't know, for the latter part of 4 weeks now. I'm used to talking about it all year, but the World Food Championships is the Super Bowl of food sport, you know, and to have qualified 3 years in a row, you know, it's mind-boggling to me, because there are like 400 plus teams that entered this competition. And we all had to go to different qualifiers from all over the world. So, like, on the World Food Championship website, they haven't updated it for 2022. But there's people that have to qualify from China, Kenya,
wow.
I mean, South America. There was a guy I was competing against in my category, soup. He was from Panama.
Wow. Right?
So, when I say, some people may not look at it as a big deal because it's relatively new. They have a lot of cooking shows and competitions and things like that. But this is the world. This is really the world is involved in this. A couple years ago, man, we had a barbecue team that came from Australia and won. So, I mean, it's international, and it lives up to the hype. And, you know, Dallas has been a great host for it. We got to do it down at Fair Park at Centennial Hall. And I had an incredible turnout, you know, for the event. And I was just honored. I was in the soup category this year. It was a new category that they put in. I had never competed in soup. I usually do seafood or chicken. And so this year was a new category. So I gave 120%. You know, I left everything on the table. As football players would say, I'm old semi-pro football player. We left it all on the field. You know, even though we didn't take home the win, you know, we learned a lot, we loved a lot, we lived a lot, right? and it's okay. You know, I was down, you know, for that first day because I knew I gave my best. And if there was any more to give, I would have gave it, right? And I walked away knowing that my dish was incredible. And I had to look at it a different way. It was just somebody was better than me that day, right? And I just have to accept it. It happens. All the greats go through it, from any sports, any background, business, doesn't matter. You know, there's always going to be somebody that's one step ahead of you. There's always going to be somebody that it's their day, you know. But it gives me great encouragement with the World Food Championships that recently we had what we call a late qualifier. Usually you have to qualify by September and usually have the field already together. So we had a late qualifier at the Dallas Community College, I think it's El Centro program that they have, the culinary program that they have, right? And so I got to be what we call the chefferie for that. So I got to tell people what they could do and what they couldn't do, you know, and tell them what to expect at World Food Championships. And then I also got to judge some of the dishes. And as a judge, I saw some incredible people. And I gave them some tips on success in the World Food Championship. And one of the young man by the name of Ethan, I think his team is called the Culinary Code. It consists of him, his mom, and his dad. Mm. Well, they took first place in their category, and he's the head chef. And he's also a culinary student. Wow. And so it was impressive. You know, he made those tweaks that I told him that he needed to make and what to get prepared for. And I told him at the competition, I said, if you do this same dish, I said, you'll win. You'll definitely place. You might even win first place. I said, because this is incredible. You know, this is something I would put out. This is something you would put in a restaurant. It was incredible. And for you to be 18 and do this, you know, it was wild. And then his parents were his sous chefs. And so I was just like, your parents are the sous chefs? I thought for sure it was mom or dad was the head chef. Put together an incredible lamb chop dish. He made one of the, he had the highest score. So there's two things that you do. You create a structured dish and a signature dish. And his structured dish, the highest score you can get is a 99. Okay? That's just the way the scoring system is. It's very rarely that you get a judge that's going to score, you know, 10 across the board. But the highest score you can get is like a 99 point something. The kid got 98.725 for his structured dish.
Wow.
And it was, the structured dish was Wellington. He did a beef Wellington. And man, if you go to the World Food Championship Facebook page, and, you know, scroll through some of the pictures and you see that Wellington, it was perfect. And he's in the competition with other chefs. He's a young chef, but he's with some seasoned vets in the game. And he beat the pants off of them.
Wow. Right?
I mean, it was just, and it made me feel good because he took heed to my advice on some of the little things that I told him to do. We didn't get to cook together or anything, and I can't sit here and say, you know, I taught him everything he knows. You know, but he took heed to my advice, and they came and they watched me perform and cheered me on. And, you know, he asked questions throughout the tournament as we talked back and forth. And it was just incredible, man, just to see that happen. And first time competing, you know, first time qualifying, and he took first place. So now he competes today, if he's not competing right now, to see if he goes to the final table. The final table is the $100,000 prize. And so if he wins his category today, then him and his family would be going to pay for the $100,000, you know, and hopefully, you know, as he said before, I get to advise him on how to get on how to win.
Wow.
You know, it's, man, it was incredible. And to see some of the old faces and some of the chefs that I know, you know, from all over, the chefs from Maryland, the boys from Canada, you know, the new friends that I made from the guys from Panama. You know, that's really what the sport is about, because even though we're competing against each other, you know, we build a family environment because of culinary. As much food is out there, we're a small circle. Even though there's a whole bunch of restaurants and 100% people eat, we're a small circle that once you know somebody, you know them everywhere you go, right? Mm-hmm. And man, it was just impressive, you know. Shout out to Mike McLeod of the Clan McLeod for coming up with this idea a little over 10 years ago to have a Super Bowl of food sport. And it was just incredible. It was a great experience.
I like that term, food sport. I've never heard that, Andre. But what kind of soup did you make?
Yeah.
Okay, so the first, I had to make two. So the first one was a structure soup, and it was a chowder. So the first chowder that I made was a corn and andouille sausage chowder. And that one had a little cumin, a little turmeric in it. It had butter, onions, roasted corn. Actually, yeah, it was cast iron skillet roasted corn on top of that. So it was a little bit of chard, had a nice little bite to it, and some fresh andouille sausage straight out of New Orleans. So, you know, it came out buttery and great. I mean, I placed 19th out of 35. So I wasn't super disappointed, you know, but I kind of knew, you know, when I looked at the score, I was like, either I had too much spice to it, you know, and I didn't appeal to their palate. So, mm-hmm. you know, but like I said, great dish. And then the second dish I did, we called it a Zydeco soup. And so in the Zydeco soup, it had a combination of andouille sausage, once again, with shrimp and scallops, corn, and our signature design, we had a stuffed chicken wing, okay? So we take a drumette, and we open up the drumette, and we stuff it with the ingredients that's inside the soup. So it had corn, shrimp, scallop, and andouille sausage minced on the inside of the chicken, and then the chicken was roasted and skewered. Ooh. And put on top of the soup as a garnish. And for me, man, that was probably one of the best soups, if not the best soups, you know, my team has made. You know, my sous chef came up with the whole recipe for it, and we just knocked it out of the park. You know, where is it? You know,
yeah, definitely making me hungry.
A couple of pictures.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it was exhilarating. You know, many, I don't talk about it much, but you know, I played several years of semi-pro football for the Dallas Knights. And when I stopped playing ball, I wanted something that still gave me that same energy, or gave me that same thrill, that wasn't as treacherous to my body.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I enjoy football. It was great aggression. And when I found food sport probably about 6 years ago and started competing, it was just like a light bulb went off. I said, boy, this is just like being on the football field. It's that same intensity. It's that same drive. It's that same, you know, initial butterflies. It's that same nervousness. It's that same excitement, you know. And I know I'm probably going to be on this year. I was on last year's sizzle reel as well. Because I probably do have, I don't know, maybe out of 350 chefs, there may be one other chef that has more energy when they come to the plate. Because I'm just like, you know, screaming and howling, just like, let's go. So, but a highlight was, I didn't realize it, but I actually have a speaking part on the 2019 sizzle reel. So there's a sizzle reel that's out there on the website, worldfoodchampionships.com. And you click on 2019, I think I'm day one sizzle reel, and the guys are going around interviewing everybody. Now, granted, there's 348 chefs, you know, that they go and interview and talk to. And they came and interviewed me, and I got to talk, and they featured me in the sizzle reel. So, you know, even though I might not have won the tournament, you know, that's a win for me, because that's a video that's not going anywhere for years. So people are always going to see my face and my name pop up. And, you know, I feel good about that.
Wow. Very good. So how many black chefs were in this competition?
Out of the 338 teams, I want to say 17.
That's it?
Yeah, 17. Wow. 17 out of 338 teams or so.
Really?
Yeah, about 17. And there's a highlight to it, though. God, what is the name of her team? I was just talking about this morning. In the dessert category, the 2019 and 2016, she won in 2016 the dessert category champion, and she won in 2019 the dessert category. She won again this year, a black lady from Georgia. I don't know why I can't think. I literally was talking to somebody about this morning because we were talking about the disparity of chefs of color that is in this tournament. And the more we got to thinking about it, a lot of times, you know, most of the culinary world really don't know about the tournament. The more and more people that I talk to, you know, chefs of color, even my chefs that are counterparts, you know, I talk to them, they're like, what is the World Food Championship? I'm like, you're in culinary? You never heard of this? I mean, it's like 9 years now. It's not, you know, 1 or 2 years old. Like when my sous chef, my wife, competed back in 2014 when it was 3 years old. I'm like, this is like 10 years. It's been on all the news media outlets, and it's been on the travel network. It's been on the food TV networks. Like, how did you miss this one? But there's not as many people that know about the championship unless you're somebody that competes. You know, that you have to be a competition chef to really know this. If you're working in a restaurant and that's all you do is work in a restaurant, all you do is cater, all you do is work at a hotel, you know, oftentimes you're working 12, 15, 18 hour days and you're not thinking about competing in any kind of tournament, you know. And the buzz for it has not been where it needs to be. And that's one of the things that I want to do, especially for the people of color, really get the word out. The more I thought about it, because me and Colette talked about this before, you know, I was like, why isn't there more black chefs? You know, is it because they're losing to their counterpart chefs, or is it the awareness and knowing about it? And the more I looked at it, even over the years, a lot of chefs just don't know about it. They just don't know. And the reason I found out about it was two reasons. You know, my sous chef, she participated in a brand new qualifier, and she told me about it, and I told her I'd be, you know, she was going to do it by herself. And I just happened to ask the people, you know, can I join it? And it was like, sure. And so the qualifier, when we were doing it, it was for Texas Super Chefs. And so I didn't know that it was linked to the World Food Championships when I competed. Well, I won, right? Took first place. And they said, well, now because you took first place, you have an automatic bid into the World Food Championships. Mm. And like I said, that was 5, 6 years ago. And I was just like, what? The World Food Championships? What is that? You know, I was even surprised. I'm thinking, you know, I'm happy to be Texas Super Chef. You know, I didn't realize this was to qualify for a bigger tournament. And I really think that there is just a disconnect with food sport being the way it is as opposed to how it's portrayed on TV. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons why we don't have more chefs. Like, there's a good chef guy that I know in my hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, Daryl Super Chef Ferguson. I don't know if you ever heard of him.
No.
But he owns several restaurants in my hometown. And one of them is called Super Chef Breakfast. And the one he just opened is called The Dripping Seafood, The Dripping Shack. I'm going to think of it here in a minute. But Daryl Ferguson, he's been on Chopped. He's been on almost every cooking show. He currently was just on Guy's Grocery Games. He was on Tiny Cooking. That's a food TV show. I don't know if y'all heard of it, where you got to cook with tiny utensils and tiny food, and you have to make tiny food. And when I say tiny, I'm talking like dollhouse size.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, I am not. I said my hands are too big to even attempt to go on that show. And you've got to make food that looks like doll size food. Literally.
Really?
Yeah, I'm telling you, don't get to make big food. You got to make it literally a snack morsel, and it's got to be the best morsel you've ever made to win it. But it's a great show to watch. So Daryl's been very, very popular. He's been on a lot of different TV stations and things like that. But not once have I seen him participate in the World Food Championships or any kind of qualifiers, right? And so it's just interesting. My circle of friends, even one of my great chefs, and mentors, Alex Askew from BCA Global. He's at Black Culinary Alliance. That's one of my nonprofits that I'm a part of. When I told him about it, he said, well, what is that? Alex's been in the industry 35 plus years. You know, he's had BCA Global since he launched it on the campus of CIA when he was in college. And I'm like, in 25 years, you've never heard of this tournament. Mm. You know, it's the biggest in the world for food sport. There wow. isn't one bigger than what we do because it is international. You can qualify everywhere, you know, and it's just, I really think the disparity, you know, before when I was thinking about it, it was like, all right, it's color driven. This mm-hmm. is majority white chefs. And then the more I thought about it, that's the industry and I'm trying to educate people on anyway. All the chefs that have taught me over the years until recently have been, you know, counterparts or chefs that are Caucasian, white, you know. Now, the chef that taught me to decorate food and make it look beautiful, you know, Chef TJ Sudawasa, Philippine, you know. That's my boy right there. That's the one that taught me, man. He taught me so much at Disney, it's ridiculous.
Oh,
man. That man put me through the ringer in such the kindest way somebody could. You know, you know, when you think of Gordon Ramsay, think of Gordon Ramsay being kind, but with the same intensity and demand.
Mm.
Instead of throwing the plate at you or cussing you out, sitting the plate right next to you and saying the same things he does without cuss words, did you really just send this plate out there?
So
are you
which
really
one?
Killing me right now?
So which one is,
you know,
which one is Gordon Ramsay?
Okay, Gordon Ramsay is on Hell's Kitchen. So he's got an accent, white guy, blonde hair. He's the one who usually cuss yeah. people out.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, he is the most famous chef. He's the one that would tell you that, you know, your food looks like dog crap and use, Ooh. You know, expletives. You know, his show is built around that. I'd love to meet him to see if he's really like that or does he really just do it, you know, for the ratings. Right? Because a lot of chefs do act like that in the kitchen and cuss and do, you know, do what we do. But
I think he's really like that. And the reason I say that is simply because there's a woman, and I told you about her. She has a place in Pasadena, just south of Old Town.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got a Jamaican restaurant. And I don't even know if she's still there, but it's a Jamaican restaurant. And we used her venue for a party. We initially thought that it would be a great collaboration. And I found out from my girlfriend, who is a chef, so she watches all of the chef programs. She told me that the woman was on that show, the Gordon Ramsay show. And I can't remember the name of it. But
Hell's Kitchen.
Okay, well, she went on that show, and apparently they had a major clash on camera. Mm-hmm. And he told her on camera she will never make it, that her business would never make it. He told her she didn't know what she was doing, that she would never make it, she ought to quit. Oh my God. And I thought, oh, no, really? Well, after dealing with her for the short period of time that we did, it wouldn't surprise me if she's out of business. It wouldn't surprise me. Because her food was, it was okay. It wasn't great. It was okay. But beyond that, she is a very, very, very nasty person. She is a terrible business person. Terrible. Mm. But she was on his show. And my girlfriend, Marsha, kept saying, she was on the show. Don't be surprised. Don't be surprised. She's already been told not that her restaurant would close. And it may be closed. It just may be closed. I don't know. But he told her she was absolutely nothing and that she would never make it. But she had a very, very bad disposition.
But, you know, a lot of these programs, they thrive on conflict. That's what
yeah,
makes it work. Remember, it all started with Jerry Springer, And the producers would get bonuses based on how many fights they could encourage on the stage.
I believe.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, the producers do want the cast members to be fiery. They want to see fire and ice. Yeah, they want them to be contentious. They want to see fire because for them, that's what people gravitate to. That's what people watch. They want to see the fire. They want to see the blood and guts. And as they say all the time, if it bleeds, it leads.
Girls pull their tops down and each other's tops down. Yeah, all the crazy stuff.
All the crazy stuff. Those are the things that people want to see, which I think is absolutely despicable. I think it's just absolutely despicable. So, but the woman that went on his show, she could be out of business today. She could be out of business. Yeah.
Or she could prove him wrong. You never know.
Well, based on my interaction with him, no. With her, no.
Well, you know, and Andre, maybe you can speak to this. Obviously, you're in the business. And I worked in restaurants for several years in my younger days. And watching restaurants over the years, I've seen it where somebody can do everything right. They've got everything going right. The place is a great place. They've got great staff. Its location seems to be fine, but they fail. And then other people can do everything wrong.
And they win.
And they succeed. You know, it's like people are always looking for that secret formula that makes a restaurant. Andre, do you remember the place? There was a place on Harry Hines called The Hole in the Wall. Do you know that place?
Yes. I've never been there, but I've heard of it.
He lasted for years upon years upon years, and he just finally shut it down because he didn't want to renew his liquor license because he didn't cultivate new drinkers. But the place was because everybody got older, they weren't drinking and things like that, and it was all the old musicians, and they weren't drinking, so it wasn't making any money. But the place, it was raining, it leaked pretty bad. I saw three fires there myself. There was a fire in the kitchen. There was a fire on the deck out back twice. The bar was just had chunks taken out of it, and he would just throw a mat over it. The floor had chunks out of it, and he lasted for years upon years upon years.
What?
Yeah. Oh, it was crazy. So, and when he shut down, everybody moved to another place, not too far from there. Clean, had a great stage for the musicians. Had a clean bathroom for the women. Everything was great. It lasted a year. So can you speak to that, Andre?
You know, that's a great question. So for the people that listen to the show that don't know, you know, I'm also a coach and a consultant in the restaurant industry. So there's a couple of factors. One, everybody gets lucky. That's what we say in the industry. Everybody at least has one chance at luck. Right. You know, you have something that is just terrible. An example, the lady won my category. She had so many issues because I know her personally. She was just telling me all the problems she was having. And come to find out next day, she won first place. And she was like, I don't know how I did that.
Oh, my God.
I said everything went wrong. My soup wasn't right. This wasn't right. My sous chefs were tired. You know, all these different things. And she won, you know, first place in the category. And she just thought it was the most terrible thing. And then me, on the other end, thinking I put out the incredible, most best product, I didn't even place in the top 10 this year, right? So you get lucky. That's one thing. Number two, he probably started it off that way in the business and just maintained it, and people got comfortable with it. And people go places that they're comfortable, especially when it comes to restaurants. Yeah. So the food may not have been great, but it might have been a great atmosphere. It might have been a place, you know, and without looking at the clientele, you know, if he had clientele that were middle to lower class, we would say, right?
Yes.
You know, that would come in, that would love to come in a beer, but come in with a tour shirt or be able to come in their, you know, in their a bicycle leather jacket, you know, with the hat sideways, or come in an A shirt. You know, all these different factors that go into it. It's almost like when you go into a motorcycle bar. You know, sometimes motorcycle bars be kind of run down, but it'd be completely full. It's because they feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. And he made the people feel comfortable with all the issues, you know, and he never invested any money into fixing those different things because the people were still coming. I mean, if you're going to come to a tore down place and pay me, then why would I fix it up and make it nice?
Exactly.
And pay. People got comfortable. Now, with the new improved place, most times a business fails because, A, they're in a business they don't know anything about. B, funding. It takes about 3 to 5 years to turn a profit in a restaurant. Now, restaurants are great for cash flow. Okay, but cash flow, capital, and credit, three different things. Most restaurants, when they first open, either somebody has a lot of capital or they have a lot of credit. Okay, because restaurants can go anywhere from $250,000 for a fast food restaurant all the way up to your high-end restaurants, $5, $6, $10, $20, $30 million, right? If you don't have deep pockets, you're not getting a profit for 3 years. Even if you do have deep pockets, you're not getting a profit. But you will have cash flow, right? So if you make $100,000 this month and your expenses were, say, $49,000 and you paid everything, you have $51,000 worth of cash flow. Because if you took out a loan and you put in your own money, say, I don't know, $10 million you put into it, you know, you still owe that money to the mm-hmm. investor, to the bank, et cetera, et cetera. So you're not profiting until you pay them back, because that $51,000, a portion of that goes to them. You put that in the bank. That's how you pay your payroll. That's how you get your inventory for the next month, et cetera, et cetera. Most businesses fail because they don't figure out that little niche in the cash flow system with a restaurant. Because restaurants are not fast turnaround cashes. That's why when people ask me why you didn't open a restaurant, I said catering is almost 100% guaranteed money. And they said, why? I said, in a restaurant, the same stuff you order on the menu when you sit down that is, say, $18 for your steak, they do it for catering at $27 a steak. The same exact steak you pay for in the restaurant is just because they got to put it together and take it off site and be able to set it up off site, et cetera, et cetera. So you're paying more for us to bring it to you. That's a 10% markup. Every restaurant that does catering, it's 100% profit because they're using what's in the restaurant. So when I decided to open a business instead of doing a restaurant, I was like, you know what? If 100% profit goes to the restaurant when they do catering of items they already have on the menu, that would mean if I didn't open a restaurant and just went straight catering, then I would have anywhere from 75 to 80% profit, because I'm still going to have overhead because I still got to buy product, different things like that. But I have guaranteed money. And I say guaranteed because in the catering world, you're going to pay 25 to 50 to 75% deposit and sometimes 100% all up front for your event. So if I quote somebody $25,000 for their wedding, their deposit is $12,500. And that $12,500 pays for majority of everything I need, depending on, you know, what the bride needs. Maybe they need extra ice sculptures, extra staff. Maybe they want more drapery. You know, maybe they want, I mean, I've had some crazy ones, you know, maybe they want a live snake in a box, a crocodile. What's some other, man, we do some incredible stuff. I've got some wild things. You know, there was one time I had to get a horse for this lady's outdoor wedding, you know, not for her to ride, but you know, it was part of the display, which was pretty cool. Cause I knew somebody that, you know, that did horses. So, you know, they gave me a great deal on, it's like, I just need to borrow the horse for the day. You can come with the horse or send somebody. Like, nobody's going to ride it. It's just there for pictures and things
what?
Like that.
A horse?
It's interesting. A horse. Yeah, a literal thoroughbred. And, you know, it's incredible what these ideas, you know, people come up with. But I went into catering because it's guaranteed money. Because they had to pay me that up front to get the catering. And then I collect the rest on the end. The rest on the end is profit. So at the least, I profit 50% every time I do a catering. But mostly I do 75%. And that's one of the reasons why I really haven't opened a restaurant. Because of that. Now, I'm looking into it for this coming year because the catering has been doing so well. So, you know, buy a building, open up a restaurant, run the catering, still going to be 100% profit because what's on the menu is going to be what we're going to cater. So, but those are the couple of things, Kenny, when it comes to it. Most of the time in the restaurant industry, they don't know what they're doing and they don't have the money. It's very rarely that it's the product, that the food is just so bad. Service is usually third on that list. And location is usually fourth on the list.
Really?
Yeah, because yeah, location, you can fail being in the wrong location.
Yep.
Yeah.
But it depends on the concept, right? Like an example, Kenny, have you ever been to Two Partners down in South Dallas?
Yeah, Colette, yeah. That's where we went and we talked to them. Yep.
Yes,
yep.
I remember.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Two Partners probably wouldn't do well in Plano or Frisco.
Right.
I agree. Yeah.
So when I tell people, those are the kind of examples I give people with location. You know, like Perry's Steakhouse. Have you had a chance to go to Perry's ever?
I don't know Perry's. Colette?
All right, so Perry's Steakhouse is probably known for their lunch pork chop. It's a very upscale steakhouse, but they got like a lunch pork chop that's like 8 ounces and it's like 4 inches tall. And they have this lunch special going on for it. It's like $15 with 2 side orders. It's like regular people prices. And Perry's, great steakhouse right there in Uptown. You put that in.
Oh, is that the DeSoto one on the corner?
Yeah, it's right on the corner of, I can't think of the street right now, but Paris is on the corner. Yeah, it's a corner restaurant, but, you wouldn't put a Paris, you know, in Pleasant Grove.
Right. Right. And I also noticed that when you have Restaurant Rose, restaurants at the end points generally don't make it. They've got to be close to each other and where everybody's congregating, like in the, Addison area. The ones down on the west end of Addison, they consistently fail. And as a matter of fact, what's the big one? They just shut it down a couple of years ago. Big chain.
A big chain?
Ruby Tuesday? No. They did have a Joe's Crab Shack, and it shut down years ago.
Yep, there was a Joe's Crab Shack. There was an Azul's that was over there.
Yeah, Azul's, yeah. It was like good drinking place. American Fair.
I had to think, because what I think about right now is that, you know, there was a Romano's Macaroni Grill. There's Chamberlain's is still there.
Far down on the west end, almost next to the grocery store. As a matter of fact, it's across from.
Oh, yeah. I know what grocery store you're talking about.
Yeah. What is, it's a.
I can't think of the name of the restaurant, yeah. though.
Big but, happy hour type place.
Yeah. See, most of the time, if you're in a restaurant row, and this is pretty much in any metropolitan, the ones that fail, again, is the finances. Or you have poor service when you're on a restaurant row because people have so many options. It's not a coincidence that fast food put themselves across the street or next to each other because people like options.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
And you, even if you have terrible service, when I just think about, you know, not put anybody on blast, like Burger King and Wendy's and McDonald's and sometimes Whataburger and Popeyes. And, you know, sometimes they don't have the greatest service, but people don't stop going to them because it's an option. And most of the businesses that fail are the ones that are kind of centralized by themselves, that don't have great customer service and don't have an eclectic or a quality product. That's why you see restaurants all bunched together, because people like options. And a smart restaurateur knows that. Knows that, oh, okay, if there's a vacant property that's next to Perry's, Dunson, you know, Trail House, Roof Chris, and I want to put an upscale restaurant there like a Fogo de Chao or a Texas Day Brazil, I'm going to put it right down the street or around the corner from them, so that people see me as an option.
Right, exactly, yep.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's great to be the first one in populated locations, but it's even better once it gets populated. You know, once you, it's great to be the first one and there's not many options, because most of the people are going to come to something that's brand new in the restaurant industry. People love new stuff. So if you're the first one in a neighborhood or on the corner, oh my God, you'll make a killing first couple of years. Then you get a guy like me to come in and put a restaurant right next to it. You're not going to make as much of a killing because now I'm the new guy. And it just continues on. And then when it turns into a role, that's when your business goes from being way up to way down to be very consistent. And that's how we help each other in the restaurant industry. Build that consistency. You know? But most businesses fail because somebody don't know how to do the numbers. And that's across the board for any business.
I'm to see some struggling on the name of that. Go under. That place, I think it started with an H.
Hooligans?
No. I'll think of it. I'll think of it. I'm looking for it right
Humperdinck's?
Now. Humperdinck's. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Humperdinck's is a different story. Humperdinck's, for you guys that don't know, you know, Humperdinck's is a very, very popular sports bar. I had multiple locations here in Dallas. Same thing. Financial struggles. That's why Humperdinck's went down.
Yeah, because they were there for years down at the end. Yeah. They were the only one that survived for a long time, yeah.
Man, Humperdinck's had, I want to say, almost 10 locations here in...
sounds about right.
In the DFW market.
I remember Humperdinck's, yeah.
Yeah, Humperdinck's a great brew pub. It was a great place, you know, where you go get beer and decent drinks and... You know, I went to, you know, last time I went to a Humperdinck's, it was in the one in Arlington. And, you know, the service wasn't that great, you know, and the entire restaurant smelled like spilled beer, right? And it was probably because they had a carpet dining room. Like it does not make sense to me, you know, because that stuff soaks in and no matter how much you shampoo it and spray it and Febreze it, you know, that's just not smart. But their business started going down because of their service. I mean, I went there over and over. I used to have a networking group out in Arlington. And Humperdinck's was, we used their back room to host our network meeting events. And so we'd have anywhere from 50 to 100 people in that back room. And we would have, the, you know, the whole buffet and things like that. And it was just terrible service. I mean, we had that contract with them for almost 2 years. And there was no way to get out of the contract. It's the only reason why we were there, you know. And people still kept coming, of course. But, you know, we saw the decline way back then. And then, of course, the financial struggles came in. And when that came in, it was like, all right, because they closed before the pandemic. So they can't even blame the pandemic on that.
Yeah, I just put something in the chat about that.
You know, and the main reason... Again, somebody not doing the books right.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody not paying attention to the money. Any other thing, it could be not paying the taxes on time, quarterly like you need to, you know, not reporting what you need to report, not putting all the tips on people's paychecks like you're supposed to, any number of things, and overspending. You know, I mean... Humperdinck's had a ridiculously large menu.
And a ridiculously large bar.
Yes. Now, the large bar, I'm okay with because everything in that bar you can sell. Right? Everything goes bad, you can sell. Yeah, I mean, you can sell the fountain systems. You can sell the bottles of liquor that's on the wall. You know, you get the large bar, but the bar was extremely large. That was cool. If you're a bar that focuses more on sports, beer, and alcohol, you don't need 5 pages of food. And if you ever go back and look, I don't know if you look at an old Humperdinck's menu, when I say 5 pages, I'm talking about 5 pages with little print. I'm not talking about 5 pages that's got big print like a typical restaurant. I mean, we're talking 20 chicken items, 20 burger items,
really? 10
pork items, tacos, fish tacos. I mean, it was stupid. And for me, not stupid in the sense of being stupid. It had too much stuff. If your audience is drinking beer, it should have just been bar food. You know, I mean, they had entree foods. They had 6 or 7 desserts. I mean, Colette, it was expansive. It was unnecessarily expansive for a restaurant.
So when you have that many items, and I want to say the Cheesecake Factory
Yeah, they've got a pretty large one, yeah.
A very large, expansive menu.
Well, but Cheesecake Factory charges a heck of a lot more to keep that inventory. And if you pay attention real closely and look at the menu, even though they're giving you different items, they're using the same base items.
But they're not a drinking place like Humperdinck's either.
They're not. They're a food place.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There's a difference. But when you look at, next time you go to Cheesecake Factory and look at the menu, you notice it might be so many items on the menu, but you start seeing chicken everywhere. Or you start seeing a certain kind of beef everywhere. Now, your eccentrics like lamb chops will be out there, but if you notice, a lot of the stuff in their menu is reincorporated. It's not like it's off to the side by itself. You know, like for instance, with Humperdinck's, they had a a la carte and a salad menu. They had a chicken soup, broccoli cheese soup, garden veggie, Texas chili, house greens, Caesar spinach, and a Humperdinck's wedge. Now, that was just salad and soups at a bar. Okay? That's just a bar. Then they had five different steaks. 7 different seafood items. 6 different chicken items. Then they had 4 different flatbreads. 3 different pizzas, and then do your own pizza. Then they had lighter entrees. 4 of those. Then they had another set of separate entrees that was like 5 or 6. Oh, and then there was the brunch menu that was different on the weekends.
What?
Oh, yeah, the weekend mimosa brunch. It was chicken and waffles and French toast and eggs benedict and scrambles and breakfast tacos. There's just too much. It makes me want to cuss every time I look at the menu. There's too much stuff on here for you to be selling beer and whiskey. It's a bar. Like, you're not trying to be an upscale place. And if anybody that worked for Humperdinck's or owned Humperdinck's, you know, I'm not necessarily talking bad about you. I'm just telling the truth, okay? If that's your mainstay, stick to what you know. I tell restaurants all the time, you don't need 1,000 things on your menu. Stick to what you're good at. Profit from that, and then add things in seasonal if you get tired of cooking the same thing. It's okay.
Yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
I teach them, I said, you may not like the food from McDonald's, but I bet you know 4 items that McDonald's has been serving almost since they're opening.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because the owners of, what's the name of that? In-N-Out lived in the same area that I lived in. Uh-huh. And that was back in the 70s. In-N-Out actually has been around for probably 55, 60 years, maybe even longer. Because In-N-Out was hot when we were in high school in Pasadena, where they began. Uh-huh. And In-N-Out always said they would never change their menu. It was always going to be that very short, very well done menu item. So their hamburgers, they're not going to sell anything but hamburgers. They will have a cheeseburger, but you cannot get a variety of things from In-N-Out.
Nope. You can't get a taco. You can't get bacon on your burger. You cannot get barbecue sauce on your burger. You can't get a chicken. It's amazing. They just said, you're going to come here and you're going to get a burger. And there's some things you can do with the burger, limited. And that's it.
Yes.
And they've worked. Yeah. And I don't know if you know
soda
that.
Soda and shakes.
Yeah.
Just keep going.
Yeah. And they are a cult. It's a cult following in California. And they've come out here. And I got to tell you, we went and waited 3 hours in line when they first opened.
You waited 3 hours?
Yep.
Oh, man. Everybody did. When In-N-Out came here to Texas, oh, my God, you would have thought it was Whataburger.
Yep.
The way people waited for In-N-Out. And what was interesting, I tell people, you know, I said In-N-Out is probably the best, one of the best models to think of when it comes to, you know, do what you're good at and capitalize.
Yep.
Yeah, it's an outstanding model, that's for sure.
Because that's it. You can get a single burger or a double burger. You can get onions on it or no onions on it. You can get fresh fries. You can pick between these three shakes, vanilla, strawberry, chocolate. Right. Here's some sodas. You know, You can. What do they call those fries? Monster fries, Freakum fries. What do they call them fries?
At In-N-Out.
Not monster.
Yeah, the little special menu fries that they got. They call them something.
Well, they cut their potatoes fresh. Those are fresh potatoes. They're not.
Yes, and then there's something they put on top.
They put the secret sauce and stuff and all this stuff on, and it's called.
Yeah, it's called like Monster or something.
Why am I drawing a blank? I know them well. It's.
I can't think of it, but that model and McDonald's model is what I teach people all the time. I said, because if you go look at McDonald's menu, even going back to when the McDonald's brothers and they met, you know, Ray Kroc, right? You know, they had a cheeseburger. It was a regular cheeseburger.
Mm-hmm.
Then they added a two-layer cheeseburger and called it a Big Mac.
Yeah.
Right? Then they took their cheeseburger and called it a quarter pounder and kept their original small cheeseburger. Right? And everybody knows McDonald's has a Big Mac and a quarter pounder, cheeseburger, and fries. And even though McDonald's had all this other stuff into it, they come seasonal and go. I know y'all seen the McTaco, the McPizza, the Mc, what was that other goofy one?
You know, Rib McRib.
So, you know, there's, but they kept the same model. Big Mac has been around forever. The cheeseburger, forever. Yeah. Quarter pounder. If they stop selling anything else on their menu, they will still be extremely successful because of that consistency of that product. Mm-hmm. And too many restaurants try to do things over and over again. Great example that I like Papado's, right? Papado's has a pretty big menu too.
Yeah,
but
they do.
If you look at their menu, besides the apps, if you look at their entrees, all their entrees can be fried, grilled, or some are smoked, right? But all the seafood is in something else. It's not like they have, you know, catfish, salmon, shrimp, clams, scallops, octopus. What else is on there? Swordfish,
octopus.
Shark. You know, things that could be on the menu. They don't have all that. All right, they got shrimp. They can be fried, or you can get it grilled, or you can get it pan-seared. You know, scallops, clams. You buy these large platters. And they've been selling the same stuff all the time, and people think it's the greatest thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, by the way, it's animal style at In-N-Out.
Animal style, yeah. That's what it's called. But, you know, and Papado's been saying the same thing since I first heard of them when I moved to Houston in the 90s. Their menu has not changed. They added in some seasonal stuff. It didn't work. They threw it out. It's been the same thing. Mm-hmm. And too many restaurants try to do too much in the beginning.
I agree with that. Consistency is key. We were in Italy, and we had been in Monte Carlo, like a week in Monte Carlo, and we went down to Italy, and we've been eating all this, the local food. And when we got to, not Rome, we were in Venice, my body needed something familiar. And I don't eat at McDonald's, but I needed something American. We found a McDonald's in Venice, Italy, and went inside, and I ordered a Big Mac and ate that Big Mac. Because my body needed something it was familiar with. Even though I don't eat that often, I know what it tastes like, but I just needed that. And guess what? It tasted exactly like the cheeseburger, the Big Mac here. So consistent. Really? It is something to be said for consistency, yeah.
I don't know if I could do that. I couldn't eat any. I haven't eaten at McDonald's. Andriana is 39. I probably have not had anything from McDonald's. Oh, no. The last day of chemo, I had a fish burger. For some reason, I was craving like crazy a fish burger. That was in 2001. But prior to that, Andriana's 39, 38 years, I have not eaten at McDonald's.
Wow. And it's interesting that you craved a fish sandwich.
Yeah, I did.
That's something we might explore next call. Why does she crave that fish sandwich? What enzyme in her mind or in her body told her, I want, you know, a fish filet sandwich from McDonald's?
Yeah, I don't know.
Were you coming out of a surgery or something like that?
Coming out the last day of chemotherapy.
Last day of chemo.
Uh-huh.
So, you know what? I'm going to explore that and see what might have triggered that. That's an interesting conversation.
Yeah, it was gross. And I went and got it. And I thought, okay. And that was it. That was in 2001. And I have not had anything like that since, and I will not. I don't eat from that place. No, indeed. No, indeed. That's not going to happen.
And you talk about service, Andre. You know, when you go to these super high-end restaurants, you know, the food is good. No doubt about it. The food is going to be very good. But, you know, a lot of times the portions are small. But you really go for the service, in my estimation. You get that really impeccable service. I remember my wife and I, before we left California, we both had high-stress jobs. And we went for a late dinner one night. I can't even remember the name of the place. Way down on Hollywood, Sunset Boulevard. It was like 9, 10 o'clock at night. And there was hardly anybody in the restaurant. And we had four waiters.
What?
We had four waiters. And as a matter of fact, just my luck, I got up to go to the restroom and Stevie Wonder walked in. And I got back and my wife said, Stevie Wonder had just walked in. But we had four waiters. I do not remember what I ate. I do not remember the name of the restaurant. I do not remember except for Stevie Wonder was there and we had four waiters. So I remember that. That's how good that served. We had one guy standing there with a bottle of wine, just waiting for our wine glasses. You know,
and they don't do that anymore.
They pour the wine. That. One guy took the order. Another guy, two or three people bringing food, bringing water. Insanely great, great. And we paid a premium for it. And we were happy to pay that. You know, and that was back in the, you know, late 80s. So.
Wow. And there's nothing like that today. Yesterday, my sister and I went to a so-called new Mexican restaurant on Beltline over in Mesquite. And she wanted to go there because it's new. And she says there's been about 5 or 6 restaurants in this location and they don't seem to make it. Well, this Mexican restaurant, they've only been there 8 months. And the girl behind the counter, it's been a very long time since I have encountered someone with such a nasty, cold, pissy disposition. She went so far as to tell me I wanted a bag for the box that I had, a to-go box. And she said, you can just put it in that bag right there. She had a bag sitting on the counter for something else. And she says, you can just put it in that bag. I said, that's not my bag. And my sister said, that's going to be for the carrot cake. I didn't know that. She was so incredibly nasty. And just, you could tell she didn't want to serve anybody. You could just, it was, and I really wanted to tell her she was in the wrong place. She was definitely in the wrong place because she... Her disposition, her attitude was just
horrible.
Horrible. It was just horrible. It was just, oh, God. And what it did for me, it just said, I don't need to spend my money there.
Yep. Don't go there no more.
Yeah, I just.
May be able to speak to this also. Once a restaurant has been about 3 or 4 different places, anything subsequent is not going to last.
Yeah.
You know, that's always been an anomaly, you know, because there's some great locations out there that I've seen turn over 4, 5, 6 times, different restaurants. And, you know, talking to the restaurants, I said, man, it's got to be the owners and cash flow, man. I said, because some of these locations are great, like Humperdinck's, where all of theirs were in great locations. You know, the one in Arlington was right across the street from Six Flags. I'm just like, how do you not make money at least when the weather is warm until it got cold right there at Six Flags with Texas, with the baseball stadium right down the street. You know, this is before AT&T Stadium was there. It's like, how do you continue to lose money? It didn't make any sense. You know, it didn't make any sense. And then we look at the service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And is everything. Service is everything. You can have bad food. Well, you can't have real bad food. But the food can just be just subpar. But the service is great. You go back for the service. You don't mind paying for the service. But when the service is bad, nobody wants to go back.
Nope.
Nobody wants to go back. Nobody wants to be bothered. And the food has got to be exceptional because the service is so bad. But that doesn't usually happen. That doesn't happen.
So, well, it has been a great show. I mean, yes. we had a great conversation so much that it's time for my outro music to come on. So This is Chef Dre Blast. Thank you so much for tuning in for Menu Mondays with myself, Colette, and Kenny. We definitely look forward to coming back with you next Monday, 3 p.m. Central Standard Time on Intentional Talk Radio Network, ITRN.com. We thank you so much for your time and listening, and we look forward to hearing from you next time we're on the podcast. So if you want to be on the show, let me know.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, Chef. And once again, congratulations. What an honor. What a privilege to sit here with you. So thank you so much. Thank you so much. And we enjoyed the show. We're glad to talk to you about all things cooking, all things chefery. So thank you very much, folks. Stay tuned. We've got another great show for you this afternoon. We've got Mindful Mondays with Dr. Corliss Bennett and her guests. So we'll be with you at the next hour, 5 p.m. on the West Coast, 7 p.m. right here in Central, 8 p.m. on the eastern side of the country. So we'll talk to you then. Stay tuned, folks. Remember, ITRNradio.com. Take care.
I holla.